What happens when a carefree summer in Greece turns into a nightmare that follows you for a decade? Ella Berman's gripping psychological thriller, Before We Were Innocent, explores this question through the complex friendship of Bess and Joni, whose lives are forever altered by the death of their friend Evangeline during their post-graduation trip to Greece. 10 years after being acquitted of murder charges, Bess has retreated to a desert cabin, working remotely and avoiding human connection. When Joni suddenly reappears at her door asking for an alibi, Bess is pulled back into a web of secrets, lies, and unresolved trauma. The novel has captivated readers since its 2023 release, earning praise from Taylor Jenkins Reid and becoming a Book of the Month Club selection. With its nuanced exploration of female friendship, media vilification, and the lasting impact of trauma, Berman's work resonates particularly in our true crime-obsessed culture, asking us to consider how we flatten complex women into simple narratives. At the heart of this psychological thriller lies the intricate, sometimes toxic friendship between three young women, Bess, Joni, and Evangeline. Their relationship exemplifies the intensity of teenage female bonds, fierce loyalty intertwined with jealousy, power struggles, and deep interdependence. In 2008, these three Calabasas teenagers embark on a graduation trip to Greece, staying at Evangeline's family home in Tinos. The dynamic between them is immediately established. Evangeline is the wealthy, somewhat controlling friend who plans their activities. Joni is the fierce, unpredictable rebel, and Bess is the bridge between them, often feeling like she's struggling to keep up. Their friendship is marked by subtle power plays and shifting alliances. When Evangeline's brother Theo arrives with friends, the delicate balance is disrupted. Bess develops feelings for Theo, creating tension with Evangeline, who feels possessive of her brother. Meanwhile, Joni, terrified of being abandoned after her father's recent departure, manipulates the situation to maintain control over her friends. What makes this portrayal so compelling is how accurately it captures the suffocating intensity of teenage friendships. When Evangeline controls their meals and activities, when Joni and Bess whisper complaints about Evangeline behind her back, when all three perform exaggerated versions of themselves around Theo and his friends, these moments feel painfully authentic. The girls exist in a pressure cooker of emotions, each afraid of the impending separation college will bring, each trying to assert control in different ways. The friendship fractures when Bess and Evangeline have a vicious argument on a cliffside path. Bess walks away, leaving Evangeline alone on the treacherous rocks. When Evangeline falls to her death, the aftermath reveals just how fragile their bond truly was, and how quickly the outside world would reduce three complex young women to caricatures: the victim, the manipulator, and the follower. Berman masterfully explores how media narratives shape public perception and personal identity. After Evangeline's death, Bess and Joni are immediately cast as villains in a sensationalized story. A simple photo of them eating ice cream on the beach becomes evidence of their callousness. Their private text messages, social media posts, and even a vibrator found in their hotel room are used to paint them as depraved party girls who corrupted the shy, beautiful, reluctant, sweet Evangeline. The novel shows how readily the public consumes these simplified narratives. Witnesses misremember details to fit the emerging story. Bess is suddenly remembered as controlling and boy crazy, though neither description matched her actual personality. One article describes them conducting blood rituals with menstrual blood, a complete fabrication that nonetheless becomes part of the public record. The girls are transformed into sex-crazed Jezebels who lured their friend to her death. What's particularly insightful is how this media portrayal affects the women's self-perception. After their release from prison, Bess retreats entirely from public life, moving to a desert cabin and working a job that requires minimal human interaction. She internalizes the shame, making herself so small that she barely exists. Joni takes the opposite approach, building a brand around her experience, becoming a self-help guru who teaches others to choose their way to happiness. Yet beneath her confident exterior, she remains defined by trauma, admitting that her book is the culmination of every single thing I've done or said since the moment Evangeline died. 10 years later, when Willa disappears, the media immediately connects it to Evangeline's death, proving that no matter how much time passes, Bess and Joni will always be viewed through the lens of that one tragic summer. This exploration of how women are flattened into simple narratives, victim or villain, angel or demon, feels particularly relevant in our current media landscape. Trauma reshapes both women in profoundly different ways. Bess chooses invisibility, working remotely for a dating app as a content moderator, where her only options are to ignore, block, or warn. This job serves as a perfect metaphor for how she approaches her own life, keeping people at a distance, making swift judgments, and avoiding deeper connections. Her desert cabin, with its sparse furnishings and isolation, reflects her emotional state. She has constructed a life designed to leave no trace, to attract no attention. Joni's response to trauma is equally extreme but opposite. She transforms her experience into currency, building a successful career as a motivational speaker and author. She crafts a carefully curated public image, complete with a beautiful Malibu beach house and designer clothes. Yet her life remains just as constrained as Bess's. She admits to fantasizing about paddleboarding far out to sea to escape everything, revealing that her apparent freedom is just another form of prison. The novel sensitively portrays how trauma doesn't just change who you are in the moment, it alters who you might have become. Bess wonders about who I might have been if I just tried harder, been better, not let the shame take hold. She can't even imagine an alternate reality where she ended up with Theo because her mind refuses to form the image. The trauma has not only taken her past, but stolen possible futures as well. Perhaps most poignantly, the novel shows how trauma isolates. When Bess returns to Calabasas after prison, her family treats her like a fragile stranger. They rename her experience with euphemisms: the accident, when you were away, simply in Greece, unable to directly address what happened. Even her brother Stephen, who loves her, admits that her behavior is sucking the air out of this house. The inability to process trauma together pushes Bess further into isolation. Throughout the novel, Berman plays with the unreliability of memory and the power of lies. The central mystery revolves around what really happened the night Evangeline died. The official story, that all three girls were together when Evangeline fell, is revealed to be false, but the truth is more complex than a simple lie. Bess believes she caused Evangeline's death by walking away after their argument, leaving her alone on a dangerous path. She carries this guilt for 10 years, only to discover that Joni was actually present when Evangeline fell. The revelation that Joni has lied to her for a decade, not just about being there, but about telling Evangeline about Theo and Bess's plans to meet in Milos, shatters Bess's understanding of their friendship. What's fascinating is how both women constructed narratives they could live with. Bess believed Joni protected her out of loyalty, which allowed her to maintain their friendship despite everything else they lost. Joni created a story where she was the protector rather than the betrayer. As Bess realizes, I'd constructed a narrative that Joni never lies to protect myself and justify bad choices. The novel also explores how memory itself is malleable. When recalling their time in Greece, each woman remembers different aspects of Evangeline. Bess recalls her controlling nature, while Joni eventually shares memories of Evangeline's humor and compassion. Neither version is complete. The truth exists somewhere in between. This theme extends to the present-day mystery of Willa's disappearance. Joni's story keeps shifting, first claiming Willa is just seeking attention, then admitting to a physical altercation before her disappearance. Each revelation forces Bess to reconsider what she knows about her friend and whether she can trust her own judgment. Loyalty, its power, its limitations, and its devastating cost, forms a central and complex theme that reverberates throughout the narrative. When Joni appears unexpectedly at Bess's door after a decade of silence, she strategically appeals to their deepest shared history. I came here because there isn't anyone else in the world I trust as much as I trust you. Despite having every logical reason to refuse, a stable marriage, a carefully constructed new life, and the weight of past betrayals, Bess agrees to provide an alibi, demonstrating the profound and often irrational pull of their childhood bond. Throughout the novel, loyalty is portrayed as both a cherished virtue and an insidious trap. Joni's extreme attachment to Bess and Evangeline, manifesting as an almost pathological terror of abandonment, leads her to increasingly manipulative behavior. She orchestrates elaborate scenarios to keep them close, uses their secrets against them, and ultimately betrays them both in ways that irreparably damage their lives. Bess's loyalty to Joni causes her to construct an intricate web of lies, to the investigating officers, to her increasingly suspicious husband Marcus, to her worried parents, and most destructively, to herself. The cost of this misplaced loyalty proves immense. Years spent in self-imposed isolation, permanently fractured family relationships, and a life perpetually constrained by the twin shadows of fear and shame. The novel repeatedly challenges readers to consider whether there are moral limits to what we owe even our oldest friends. This question comes to a head when Bess discovers Willa's phone hidden in Joni's drawer, concrete evidence of her friend's involvement in a teenager's disappearance. This discovery finally pushes Bess to her breaking point, leading to the confrontation where she tells Joni, "I can't save you anymore." This pivotal moment represents crucial psychological growth, the painful but necessary recognition that true loyalty doesn't require enabling or defending destructive behavior. Yet even as Bess attempts to establish this boundary, the novel poignantly acknowledges the near impossibility of completely severing such deeply rooted bonds. Joni's chilling reminder, "It's too late, Bess. Don't you see that? Whatever you do now, we'll always be bound together," proves prophetic. The shared history, secrets, and emotional entanglement create a connection that persists beyond choice or reason. This reality is symbolized in the novel's final pages when Bess, despite everything, finds herself keeping a weathered photograph of the three friends together, unable or unwilling to let their shared history completely fade into obscurity. The image serves as a bittersweet reminder that some bonds, even toxic ones, leave permanent imprints on our lives. Both protagonists struggle with questions of identity throughout the novel. Who are they beyond the tragedy that defined them? Is reinvention possible after such public vilification? Can they ever escape the roles assigned to them? Bess's approach is to erase herself. She moves to the desert, works remotely, and avoids forming new relationships. When her mother calls from Spain, she painfully confesses she sometimes wonders who Bess might have become if they'd never moved to California, saying she feels like she's mourning someone I never got a chance to meet. This captures Bess's central struggle. She's lost not just her former self, but the potential of who she might have been. Joni takes the opposite approach, creating an entirely new public persona as Joni Laban, a self-help guru who teaches others to transform trauma into success. She builds a brand around the very experience that destroyed her previous life. Yet this reinvention is revealed to be superficial. Underneath her polished exterior, Joni remains defined by fear of abandonment and need for control. What makes this exploration particularly nuanced is Berman's refusal to judge either approach. Both women are shown to be survivors, doing what they need to endure. Neither has found true peace or authentic reinvention, but both have found ways to continue existing in a world that tried to define and dismiss them. By the novel's end, Bess begins to glimpse the possibility of a different kind of reinvention, one based not on escaping the past, but on integrating it. As she reconnects with Theo and meets his wife Sophia, she realizes, maybe it's okay if Theo isn't my ending. She starts to imagine a future where she might find sweet longing, where I now feel sorrow, suggesting that true reinvention comes not from erasing the past, but from finding new meaning in it. Class and privilege form a complex undercurrent throughout the narrative, shaping relationships, perceptions, and ultimately justice itself. The three friends come from Calabasas, an affluent Los Angeles enclave known for its gated communities and celebrity residents, a place that Bess's more traditional British parents view as morally corrupting. Yet even within this rarefied world of swimming pools and security systems, stark distinctions exist. Evangeline's family possesses extraordinary wealth. Their holdings include a centuries-old stone house overlooking the Aegean Sea, a sprawling mansion in California with its own orangery, and a fleet of luxury vehicles. Meanwhile, Bess, who relocated from a middle-class London suburb at 15, feels perpetually like an outsider attempting to decode the unwritten rules of American affluence. These class differences manifest in subtle yet significant ways. Evangeline casually mentions weekend trips to Paris, while Bess carefully saves her babysitting money for designer jeans. Joni, straddling the middle ground between them, comes from local wealth but not international fortune. When tragedy strikes, these distinctions become weaponized. The media immediately casts Evangeline as the pure, innocent victim, the wealthy man's daughter led astray. In contrast, Bess and Joni are portrayed as calculating social climbers who wormed their way into Evangeline's life. Tabloids speculate about their motives, suggesting elaborate schemes to sell her virginity to wealthy men or blackmail her shipping magnate father. Their previous friendship is rewritten as a predatory relationship. The novel masterfully explores how privilege shapes not just public perception, but the very mechanics of justice. When Bess and Joni are released after 6 months in prison, despite a lack of new evidence, whispers circulate that Stavros Eidos, Evangeline's powerful father, pulled strings behind the scenes. The suggestion that justice might bend to wealth and connections isn't presented as shocking, but rather as an accepted reality of their world. Even their prison experience reflects their privilege. They serve time in a minimum security facility, while their public defender mentions other clients in much harsher conditions for lesser crimes. In the present timeline, Joni's carefully constructed new life becomes a study in the transformation of notoriety into privilege. Her Malibu beach house, lucrative book deal, and carefully curated wardrobe of designer clothes represent a different kind of social capital. Her ability to rebuild after disgrace stems partly from her skilled manipulation of media attention, but also reflects the invisible advantages of her background, education, social connections, and cultural knowledge that help her navigate her post-scandal life. This stands in stark contrast to Lucien Miller, Willa's lover who becomes the prime suspect in her murder. His old Toyota Camry and life in his grandmother's modest condo represent not just financial limitations, but a broader lack of social resources. Without access to top-tier legal representation or media consultants, he faces the justice system's full weight without the buffering effect of privilege. As the novel progresses, both women must confront whether they can ever be truly free while carrying so many secrets. The theme of freedom versus happiness emerges explicitly in Joni's published article, which quotes Zamyatin. What is it that people beg for, pray for, dream about? They want to be happy, and they will never rise to their feet until you make them forget what happiness is. Initially, both women choose versions of happiness over freedom. Bess accepts a limited existence, small, controlled, but safe from further judgment. Joni creates an illusion of freedom through success and public reinvention, but remains trapped by her secrets and fears. Neither approach brings true peace. The path to genuine freedom begins when Bess finally acknowledges the truth, first to her brother Stephen, then to Theo. By admitting she wasn't present when Evangeline died, by confronting Joni about her decade of lies, Bess takes the first steps toward authentic liberation. Though painful, this truth-telling allows her to imagine a future not defined by shame and secrecy. Joni's fate remains more ambiguous. Her disappearance, possibly a suicide by paddleboarding out to sea, as she once described fantasizing about, suggests she couldn't find a way to reconcile truth and survival. Yet she leaves behind her article about their friendship, which offers a more honest portrayal of all three women than the media ever provided. This final act of truth-telling may be her own bid for freedom, even if she couldn't face living with the consequences. The novel ends with Bess beginning to understand that true freedom comes not from escaping the past, but from integrating it into a more authentic present. As she drives away from Thieb's house, she realizes that one day she might tell our story, the story of three teenage girls living between the labels the world gave us. In this potential future act of truth-telling, she glimpses a freedom that neither hiding nor reinvention could provide. In the novel's final pages, Berman offers a tentative hope for renewal, crafting a delicate balance between acknowledging lasting wounds and embracing future possibilities. After 10 years of self-imposed isolation and crushing shame, Bess begins to open herself to new connections, a process that unfolds with the gradual, hesitant quality of ice thawing. Her dinner with Theo and Sophia represents more than simple reconciliation with the past. It becomes a bridge between who she was and who she might become. Though she still carries the weight of her grief, she discovers it has evolved into something more nuanced, what she describes as a sweet longing rather than the sharp-edged sorrow that once defined her days. This renewal isn't portrayed as a dramatic transformation or neat resolution. Instead, Berman presents it as a quiet awakening to possibility, marked by small but significant shifts in perspective. When Bess allows herself to imagine someday having daughters of her own, she notices how she's begun to see teenage girls differently. Their mannerisms, the way they toss their hair, their infectious laughter, their fierce loyalties now register as precious echoes of Johnny and Evangeline rather than painful reminders of loss. She's not erasing her trauma, but recontextualizing it, finding new meaning in the memories that once threatened to overwhelm her. Through this lens, she understands that Johnny's lasting legacy wasn't just tragedy, but the knowledge that I'll never be the one to limit their possibilities. What makes this conclusion so affecting is its unflinching realism and emotional authenticity. Bess doesn't suddenly shed a decade of trauma and shame like an outgrown skin. Instead, she begins to see beyond its boundaries, recognizing that her story didn't end with that fateful summer in Greece. The novel suggests that healing isn't about returning to some idealized previous version of yourself. That person, shaped by innocence and untouched by tragedy, is irretrievably gone. Instead, healing requires finding the courage to begin again from where you are, carrying your past not as a burden, but as part of your foundation. In this way, Before We Were Innocent offers a nuanced and profound exploration of resilience. It acknowledges the devastating impact of trauma, media vilification, and broken trust, while illuminating the subtle ways people find their way forward. Through Bess's journey, Berman shows how healing often comes not in dramatic moments, but in quiet revelations, in shared meals, in unexpected laughter, in the gradual recognition that you can hold both grief and hope in the same heart. The novel suggests that even after everything, after loss, after shame, after a decade of hiding, there remains the possibility of finding your way back to yourself. Not to the self you might have been, but to a new self, one shaped by experience, yet still capable of growth, connection, and the courage to imagine a different future. The title, Before We Were Innocent, carries multiple meanings that resonate throughout the narrative. Most obviously, it refers to the time before Evangeline's death, when the three friends were just teenagers on a summer adventure, untouched by tragedy or public scrutiny. Yet the novel complicates this notion of pre-lapsarian innocence. Even before the fatal night, the friends were engaging in behavior they'd later be condemned for: drinking, casual sex, petty cruelties toward each other. What they truly lost wasn't innocence in the moral sense, but rather innocence as freedom from consequence. Before Evangeline's death, they existed in that liminal space between childhood and adulthood, where actions seemed disconnected from permanent outcomes. They believed they could hurt each other, make mistakes, and still move forward unscathed. The tragedy forced them to confront the irreversibility of certain choices. The title also speaks to the public perception of innocence. After their acquittal, Bess and Joni were legally innocent, but would never be seen that way by much of society. The novel explores how women, particularly young women, are rarely afforded the presumption of innocence in the court of public opinion. Their behavior is scrutinized and judged by standards that wouldn't be applied to young men in similar circumstances. Finally, the title points toward the future. By the novel's end, Bess begins to imagine a life beyond shame and hiding, not a return to innocence, which is impossible, but perhaps something equally valuable, the wisdom that comes from surviving what once seemed unsurvivable. In acknowledging that she can never go back to who she was before, she opens the possibility of moving forward into something new.